Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're looking at the role of satire in the US elections and asking the question, how funny is the presidential race? In the next couple of days, we'll know who the new leader of the free world is. And no matter the outcome, this will probably go down as the most talked about election in history. Whether it's actors getting dressed up in toupees and orange makeup on late night TV, or the sheer ridiculousness of some of the candidates' opinions, much of the election has been laughable. Over the next half hour, we'll assess the way that the media has satirised the two most talked about names of the year, Clinton and Trump. When you have a candidate who pretty much writes his own jokes, do we even need comedians to point them out? It's not always a laughing matter, but you've got to laugh, right? That's all ahead on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The world has been abuzz with everyone's two cents on the presidential election, but who's been having the best time poking fun at our candidates and whose jokes have met tumbleweed? New York Magazine's Vulture.com's senior editor is Jesse David Fox, and he's on hand to give us his verdict on the best and worst televised satire of the 2016 US election.
This presidential election has given us a lot to talk about and has given comedians a lot of material to work on. And, you know, here are just some highlights from that.
I am at a disadvantage because I didn't bring my glasses. This is such small writing.
You know what we can do? We can have a bigger copy made of these pages.
Let me just do it.
Would you be able to read this section and tell us what your understanding of it is?
Objection. Mr. Trump isn't a lawyer.
Objection! How can you expect someone who isn't a fancy pants lawyer to read words?
I think Samantha Bee and her show Full Frontal is maybe more than anyone in this election has really ascended to a higher position than she was in kind of the cultural conversation. Her show offered just a different take in kind of comedic satire. It's more visceral, it's more angry, it's more fast, and you know, it might not change opinions, but it does offer real catharsis as an American who just can't deal with how grotesque this election has become. I think another comedian who has ascended a little bit through this election is Seth Meyers, who always was kind of seen as more political, but through his Closer Look segment has really, really kind of been a destination for this in a way that Jon Stewart was maybe in previous elections.
He's so paranoid that last night in Florida, he even told a crowd that as he flew over the Everglades, he was afraid he'd get eaten by an alligator.
When you fly over the Everglades and you look at those gators and you look at those water moccasins going, you say, I better have a good helicopter. I told the pilot, you sure we're okay?
I think Trump's fear of alligators solidifies his role as 2016's Captain Hook. But you know, with a super tiny hook.
He has a certain version of exasperation and a thoroughness that has just been kind of a must watch every morning to see kind of his take on each thing. And, you know, speaking of Seth Meyers, you know, who was, you know, the writer of the famous Sarah Palin sketches on Saturday Night Live? Saturday Night Live still kind of reaffirms how important and prominent it can be. You know, even though every day people are making jokes, still Saturday Night Live became appointment viewing and got its best ratings it really has had in almost 8 years. I think especially that Friday afternoon, late Friday afternoon, when, you know, the clip came out of Donald Trump saying, grab her by the pussy, that they were able to, in 24 hours, turn around a sketch that really kind of captured how toxic this person was. In a way, because Alec Baldwin kind of has a little bit of that kind of misogynist grossness in him as well. And that ability for Saturday Night Live to still be a destination, you know, after being on the air for 40 years, is, you know, a testament to what the show has and their ability to keep on, you know, finding new angles on things.
Mr. Trump, this leaked audio showed you saying, you know, I can't quite say it on live television, but basically, you said you wanted to...
grab them by the pussy.
I think the moment that everyone will remember as a low light, and I think, you know, if Trump wins, God forbid, the moment that people will point to as like part of satire's failing is when Donald Trump was on Jimmy Fallon. And it's not Jimmy Fallon's job to attack Donald Trump, but he didn't have to be so nice about it. And, you know, that moment where he, you know, rubs his hair was really just is too much for a lot of people to swallow.
Can I mess your hair up?
The answer is yes, but the people in New Hampshire, where I'm going to be in about an hour from now, I hope they're going to understand.
You say yes?
Go ahead, with my hair spray.
I get Jimmy Fallon. I'm a generally defender. He does the show that he wants to do. You know, sometimes people treat people like normal candidates when they're not normal candidates, and that was really hard for people, and that image of him rubbing his hair, treating him like a dog, it was just too much, and will go down as one of kind of a low lights in like late night history. From a person that we expected much more from, I think Stephen Colbert is one of kind of the, as a person who follows comedy, one of the sadder things, maybe you could put it. You know, with the Colbert Report, he was generally seen as one of the sharpest satirists that's ever really existed. And the show, his late night show, has just never found its footing of how they wanted to go about things. You know, they were really nice at the beginning, and then they're trying to be harder, but the tone just never made sense. You know, they spend a time trying to do kind of like old Colbert bits, and that didn't make sense. You know, it just never felt vital, which is a shame because I think we all expected exactly that to be the case.
Oh. Thank you so much for being here, Secretary Cartoon Clinton, and congratulations on your historic achievement tonight.
That's what I love about America. You know, it's the only place where a Secretary of State, Senator, and lifelong public servant can be put on equal footing with a screaming cantaloupe.
When thinking about this of lowlights, I was thinking about, it wasn't necessarily low, but interesting to think about, you know, in Conan O'Brien was such a fixture for late night and is still on the air, but this election in particular, you know, I've realized he just has not at all been part of the conversation. You know, I think he is working on a show that's a little bit old school in its way of not trying to be that political. And now that we now look at late night shows to be very political because of The Daily Show, you feel like Conan has kind of been lost in time a little bit, which is a shame because he is such an icon and such an important figure in the history of American late night television.
Our first contender, hailing from right here on Fifth Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, representing the Republican Party, the one and only Trump Tower! Our second contender, hailing from just over 35 miles outside New York City, representing the Democratic Party, it's Hillary Clinton's home in Chappaqua, New York! Let the battle begin!
Well, now we've sorted that out, let's take a closer look at how the media has parodied Trump and Clinton in the run-up to this week's election. For more on the story, I'm handing you over to Monocle's executive producer, Tom Edwards.
Thanks, Rob. I'm here in Studio 2 to talk satirical media. And joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is the writer for The Atlantic, Megan Garber. Megan, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us. It's certainly been a well-covered U.S. election, perhaps better covered than any other, certainly than I can remember. Everyone's been trying to get their two cents in, a lot of personality to poke fun at. How well do you think the people, you know, who are tasked with giving the lighter take on the presidential race have done this time around?
I mean, I think pretty well. It's very hard this time around simply because, like you said, the personalities are so outsized, you know, particularly on the Trump side, just in the sense of he's such a showman and he's such a sort of larger than life character already. So I think it's been a little bit challenging for the satirist to find, you know, that way to actually satirize him in a way that's going to feel sort of meaningful and effective. But I think in general, I mean, the politicians have given satirists and comedians so much to work with. And I think in general, they've done a good job running with it.
But Megan, I wonder, do you think maybe they should have made those blows count a little more? Because it is interesting, someone like Trump has this Teflon reputation. And in fact, with his core demographic, it seemed that the more opprobrium was heaped upon him, you know, the more they liked it. But nevertheless, the great satirist should have scored more blows. Do you think that he's just, we've never seen anything like him before? Or maybe could some of the kind of criticism and the satire been a little more effective even?
I mean, it's hard to know in retrospect, right? Because at the beginning, I think a lot of people, including just reporters in the media, didn't fully appreciate what he was going to do. You know, I think there was the attitude at first that he was a little bit of a sideshow and a little bit there for the entertainment value, that he wasn't serious about it. Perhaps his voters even weren't that serious about it. And once it became clear that he actually was a very serious contender for the presidency, people started to take him a lot more seriously. But already the groundwork had been laid that, you know, he's mostly just there for show and for entertainment. But it's such an interesting question, just what do satirists owe to the public, really? Because because I think this is one of the first elections, in my memory at least, where we really have looked to satirists to say, you know, this is the way of the world. This is the reality that we're dealing with, and really look to them in some ways as almost journalists in their own right, or at least as, you know, some kind of public intellectuals. And I think that's a relatively new thing, actually.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting point, Megan. I mean, often on here on Monocle 24, we talk about magazines, satirical magazines, certainly here in the UK, like Private Eye, for example, which often breaks really significant political stories months, sometimes even literally years before mainstream media. And I just wonder, do you think that satire and satirists then really have the power to shape the agenda? I mean, in this race, for example, Trump v. Hillary, is the power to truly sway what people are going to do in the ballot box? Does that power rest in the hand of satirists?
I think really it does in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't think that, you know, they're not journalists, so I don't think that they should be held to the same level of account as journalists might be, but I do think that they sway so much about public opinion. They really have a role in shaping, you know, just the narrative about each individual candidates, and actually, you know, individual topics as well, and just sort of general ideas about how people in the public think about the world. Comedians really do have a large say in, you know, defining that. So I think they do have a lot of power. Probably, I would say, an unprecedented amount of power just because of the functioning of the internet and the way that their ideas, you know, it's no longer in the U.S. Late night television was always such an influence on the election. But in another sense, it wasn't really, because if you didn't watch the show at 11:30 at night, you weren't really going to know what was said about the candidates and about the issues. Whereas now those ideas can be filtered through Twitter, through Facebook, through even Instagram sometimes, and people have a way of finding out what happened. And so I think comedians are so much more influential than they used to be.
Well, we've been digesting the impact of late night US TV coverage actually earlier, but I wondered, I mean, does anyone in particular stand out? Obviously, from this side of the pond, we like to see one of our own, someone like John Oliver, who's taken to it very well. But who kind of has stood out for you, whether it's the people in front of the camera or even the writers behind it?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say John Oliver has really come out this cycle and been so meaningful and valuable and influential. I think especially because even though he doesn't, I think, like to think of himself as a journalist, but he really has taken on these public interest issues that might not otherwise be talked about. I think also Trevor Noah, because of his international perspective, has been able to do something significant in terms of sort of putting things into context for the American public. His viewership is down from what it was with Jon Stewart, but I still think he's had his influence as well.
And just interestingly, and I suppose if we broaden this out and look at all comedians as well, rather than specifically at satirists, even though there's a great deal of crossover, I know you've been writing recently that you think if you look at all of the comic figures who are in the ascendancy at the moment, you've said that they are all, if not explicitly so, they are all political. And I wonder if I can throw a question that you kind of posed in one of those articles in The Atlantic back to you. Can any comedy, certainly at the moment, be apolitical?
You know, at this point, I'm not really sure. I mean, politics, it's just permeated so much of American culture at the moment. You know, it's just hard to escape it. You know, when you look at the work of Amy Schumer or Key and Peele, or like you said, any of the other comedians who are ascendant right now, there's going to be that political valence to their work. And that's just sort of the nature of it right now. And I think actually that's probably to the good. I mean, politics is not some separate thing from everyday life. It fundamentally affects everyday life. And so I think it's actually to the good that our comedy is reflecting that, because it actually does speak to how important politics is and how big these decisions really are.
That's Megan Garber, writer for The Atlantic. Thanks to her for joining us here on Culture.
Thank you, Tom. Now, there's no arguing that Trump is the easiest comedic target in this election season. He practically writes the jokes himself. Hillary Clinton, however, is often painted as far too guarded. Where's the fun in that? Our next discussion is about material that focuses solely on Clinton, where New York Magazine writer Liz Merriweather has reimagined her as a hilarious and brash let-it-all-hang-out alter ego. Jesse David Fox is back to discuss with Monocle's Clarissa Farr.
It's interesting because I think there's a variety of type of Hillary supporters, and there is a type that is very confused with the people that are like, oh, she's a lesser of two evils, because they're like, she's really great and qualified and interesting and complicated. But that is not the narrative that I think people do. It's usually like Trump and not Trump are running for president in a lot of ways of how it's framed. So I do think for people who are specifically Hillary supporters in that they are committed to Hillary. You know, people that might have voted for Hillary in the primary, this really connects to those people because it is about Hillary specifically.
Are there any moments that really stand out that you would want to highlight? I have a few, but I don't know if they're appropriate.
There's the one which is titled The Night That Obama and Hillary Founded ISIS. I think it's actually my favorite of them because it is a very funny one. The absurdity of the premise of that and be like, what would that even look like? And so there's a moment where like Obama tells Hillary his plan and then Hillary goes, isn't that plot of the first season of Homeland? Hillary asked. Obama nodded, kind of, and also a little bit of the Americans. And there's something of one, it's very casual, but also like so specifically Liz's voice and also gets to like how obviously cartoonish Donald Trump's idea of political intrigue is, that even like his critiques of Hillary are not savvy and just basically like, oh, she's like a TV villain. And there was something about that that I found so funny of how casual you have these people speaking when they're planning ISIS, a thing that they obviously didn't do. I love that. I remember in the Hillary takes a sweet, sweet nap, which is this idea that Hillary takes a nap for the first time. I think a lot, you know, a lot of this election has been talked about on Twitter where everyone's just like stating premises and people are like, yeah, that is funny. If, you know, you can imagine a tweet of just being like, wouldn't it be crazy if it is true that Obama and Hillary founded ISIS? And people are like, hell, that's so funny or whatever. But there is something to really fleshing it out beyond what is even necessary for the premise. And again, it, you know, as I've been saying, they seem like they're fun to write, which is nice because it seems like no one is having fun right now. And then again, a lot of the Liz Merriweather stuff was from the summer where maybe things were a little bit different, but one of these was pretty recently, right? The Hillary's locker room talk, which is like the fan fictioniness of it, because it's like imagining Hillary like Hillary harassing people, but like it's very specific and it's like very sexual. Right, there's one where she's like likes Ben Carson's legs and tries to hug Ben Carson's leg, and the tone of that is still also like silly in certain ways because like it's not just like they're doing it, but like the specific of oh I like Ben Carson's leg, I want to hug it, is like a very funny thing.
That's true. And I think that the tactic is really funny. Like the Hillary takes a sweet, sweet nap.
Yeah.
It's based on a tweet that Donald Trump says, where's Hillary? She's sleeping. And then it went into how shocking it would be if she took a nap.
Yeah. You know, there's something interesting that she plays with, which is there's like a Colbert Report balance of them in so much as you could imagine for some of these, a conservative reading them and not necessarily being like aware that the joke is that like this is obviously not the case, but kind of still enjoying the absurdity of like what it would look like. It's almost like, you know, if you have somewhat a reasonable conservative but also might be like, yeah, I can see that like Obama and Hillary are to blame for ISIS, right? That's like that is what a normal politician would say. But Trump, because he doesn't know how words work and what they mean, will say, you know, they founded ISIS, which doesn't make any sense. So you can imagine a person who is conservative and may be voting for Trump who can still enjoy a lot of these things and also be like not totally sure where the joke is.
Do you think that this type of comedy coverage or writing is something that is especially prevalent or effective in this election series? Or is this just, you know, Liz Merriweather being herself and expressing your opinions about something that's...
There's more of everything this election because the internet. So everything, there's more all things. I think it's actually probably something in my estimation is lacking because this election is treated like the apocalypse or voting for the apocalypse or not the apocalypse in many ways. You know, there's the subtext of all of it because of just like the tacit misogyny that it goes with almost everything that with Hillary existing. But it's also like, I think what is enjoyable about a lot of these is Hillary Clinton gets to have fun in them, right? It's like, so it's like, oh, just nice to be like, this is not a real life, but it's just like nice to enjoy that fantasy of her having a day off or her just hanging out with Barack Obama or doing anything where it seems like she's having a good time, because that does feel like fan fiction. You're like, oh, what is, you know, when can't she have a good time? Because anytime there's election season, if she says anything that is offhand, just be like, oh, you know, like casual, people be like, why, you know, like attack her. And she's lived that life for 30 years. I mean, if, right? I mean, more than 30 years. I mean, almost probably 40 years or so. So much so that, like, she has to be called Hillary Clinton. She didn't even want to be Hillary Clinton. She wanted to be Hillary Rodham. And they made her so that Bill could win re-election or whatever. So that's her entire existence is defined by how serious that everyone takes her. And we have to assume she takes herself. And so there is just nice of, like, you know, her and Barack Obama sharing a popsicle or her taking a nap, because it's just like, it's not something we get a lot of, which is just like her having a good time.
Thanks to Jesse David Fox there, senior editor at Vulture.com, part of New York Magazine. It's not just TV personalities and news journalists who've been caught up in the whirlwind of satire around the US elections. Filmmakers have been elbowing in on the conversation too. One film that caught our eye is a short 5-minute piece set in Mexico called La Madre Buena, or The Good Mother, which tells a tale of a mother torn between her politics and her child as her son demands a Donald Trump piñata for his birthday party. Producer Holly spoke to the director of the film, Sarah Cliff, to find out where the idea came from.
Entonces, Trump.
¿Cómo? ¿Trump?
Sí.
No.
I loved the idea of kind of recreating some style of Easy Rider scenes. And I thought, well, if I put the pinata so it has hair, crepe paper hair, so it flickers in the wind as it's going, it just seemed like a great challenge to take Donald Trump in a pinata form through parts of Mexico that I'm sure he's never been in his life.
And featuring Trump even in pinata form in your film, did you feel like you had a responsibility to give the film a political message?
I think that it's really important for me that the film would work on many levels, and there was a lot of things I really wanted to tackle with it. Donald Trump at the time, I mean, I wrote this in April, that's when the concept happened, and we shot in May. During that time, Donald Trump wasn't a front runner. And I think the conversations we all had on set during that time was like, there's no way he's going to be up there running for president. You know, this physically can't happen. So, yes, it was partly a political message, but I don't think as big as or as strong as it's become now. And the film had to shift and alter a little during edit as Donald Trump's campaign moved forward. I think there was many things that were bothering me, which was Mexico and the Mexican people were taking quite a bashing through all of this, you know. So not just through what Donald Trump had been saying, but it's a great country, you know, and it's treated me very well. And I've spent time there with people from all different backgrounds. And, you know, it has some issues, but I've met some amazing people who have been very kind. And some of my family are going to be Mexican. And it was just very, very frustrating. Showing there's another type of Mexico out there, I feel with a lot of sort of TV programs, news headlines, it sells a lot to focus on some of the negatives of Mexico, you know, and behind that is a beautiful country and some really incredible things there. And so that was one of the reasons to get the Trump pinata on the motorbike and going through the countryside was actually to show people a different side to what they're used to seeing.
How did the actors feel about making it?
During the casting process, I made sure that everybody not only obviously wanted to come and take part in the production, but really had a sort of a strong feeling or a felt it was important to do the film. And I actually bought a sort of a makeshift Donald Trump pinata for casting process and would sit it in the room. And I would ask the actor at the beginning of the session to just have a few words directly to the pinata and tell Donald Trump how they were feeling and what could happen with some of the things he was talking about and the effects it would have on their country and their family. And that was really interesting because that kind of gauged the actors' sensibilities where, you know, we were going to be shooting long days and obviously the actress had to learn how to ride the motorbike and do different things. And I wanted them to feel passionate about what they were doing as well as, you know, doing a great performance.
Perhaps that's your next film, The Piñata Monologues or something.
I keep getting asked to do more with it, so yeah.
And it must have been a really satisfying, you know, the end of the film where inevitably the piñata ends up at the birthday party and being used as a piñata is. It must have been very satisfying to have all these Mexican kids sort of smashing Donald Trump in the face.
I think what I really enjoyed was using the Mexican children as a picture of innocence, you know. So as we hear Donald Trump talking about Mexican citizens being rapists and murderers and all those things, just having those in the back of your mind when you're seeing these beautiful, innocent kids, you know, and that's where every Mexican child starts at. And so if anyone was going to bash Donald Trump, I think, you know, it was deserved of an 8-year-old, innocent, well-behaved boy.
And now we're just a couple of days away from election results, and it's very possible that Donald Trump could become the president. Do you see the film through a new pair of eyes now than you did back in April when you were writing it?
I think maybe there was a bit of disbelief that this concept would ever happen, you know, and I think what I latched onto was a great idea and something I thought people would like to watch and would like to see and could be part of a conversational piece. Do I see it differently now? I think it's interesting because I lived through the whole sort of Brexit thing, making the piece of film as well. So I was seeing the film in many different ways as that was happening as well, and the different messaging was going about and people's reactions and things happening in our country. So I think I've had a constant shift through the whole thing. Now, what do I worry about? I sometimes worry if, like, have we given more attention to Donald Trump than we should have done? That scares me. I really thought a lot about that and over the last few days. And I think I'm very happy I didn't go to what I feel is too far, you know, and I'm very happy that I concentrated on that narrative of a strong woman and Mexican family and a great side to Mexico, because it's important that those things were championed and highlighted. So Donald Trump didn't overtake that.
That was Sarah Clift, director of La Madre Buena. Well worth a watch just for the shots of a Donald Trump piñata on the back of a scooter. You can see the full thing at lamadrebuenafilm.com. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was the John Stewart of the whole operation, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week when we'll be talking protest songs with Dorian Lynskey and Billy Bragg, no less. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.